This is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. On the program today, we'll be reading a number of articles from a variety of sources. You'll hear about a class action lawsuit challenging the Disney Company's new Disability Access Pass policies that comes from the Los Angeles Times. You'll hear a piece from the New Yorker describing the potential impact on disabled students that efforts to dismantle the education department may have. And from the Arizona Daily Star, an article about the dangers of glaucoma. From the Arizona Republic, you'll hear about the Scottsdale City Council's decision to eliminate the Scottsdale Office of Diversity and Inclusion, as well as other items of interest. Well, let's start with that article from the Arizona Republic entitled, What Happens Next to DEI and Disability Compliance in Scottsdale? What to Know? By Taylor Seeley, published February 13, 2025. Key points. Scottsdale City Council voted to eliminate the city's Office of Diversity and Inclusion. The move leaves questions about how the city would handle discrimination complaints and ADA compliance previously handled by the office. Scottsdale's anti-discrimination ordinance remains in effect, but enforcement is unclear with the elimination of the office that oversaw it. Scottsdale eliminated its Office of Diversity and Inclusion this week, scrapping the city agency that investigates complaints related to discrimination and disability compliance. The move took place without an initial public meeting to discuss it or a presentation from city staff members about the operational, financial, or legal implications. It means Scottsdale staff must now play catch-up. Interim City Manager Greg Caton will decide which diversity office responsibilities stay and which go, based on his interpretation of what the council wants. He will determine who picks up the responsibilities that stay. Until those decisions are made, people and programs in Scottsdale are left in limbo. The diversity office was responsible for investigating complaints related to the city's non-discrimination ordinance, Federal Title IV, which bans discrimination on the basis of color, race, or national origin, and ADA compliance problems. It secured funding for the mayor's annual Ability Awards that provide scholarships to disabled students. Jackie Johnson, the diversity director, is supposed to be reassigned to a new role. Jordan Barboa, the ADA coordinator, is supposed to transfer to a new department. A $700,000 ADA transition plan lost its funding source. There's also the question of which programs that operated outside of the diversity office would be swept into the DEI ban. Scottsdale's anti-discrimination ordinance remains in effect. Council members affirmed their commitment to the ordinance at their public meeting on Tuesday. Here's what to know so far. When does the city's new ordinance take effect? A spokesperson said Wednesday the city was working to implement the ordinance and expected it to take effect before March 13. Scottsdale City Code says ordinance take effect 30 days after council approval. What happens to the ADA transition plan? The $700,000 ADA transition plan was supposed to be paid for out of the diversity office's budget, which was cut. The funding, however, still exists within the Office of Communication and Citizen Service. As long as City Council approves the expenditure, which is slated for a vote on February 18, the plan should continue uninterrupted. It's unlikely the council will reject the expenditure. The plan is federally required, and multiple council members said ADA programs were not the target of the DEI ban. Ordinance poses questions about what counts as DEI. The decisions Caton must make about what to cut and keep in the aftermath of City Council's DEI ban aren't necessarily obvious because the ordinance doesn't define DEI programming. Councilman Adam Quasman said he wanted the Scottsdale for All Storytime program nixed, for example. He told the Arizona Republic the ordinance would end it. But the head of Scottsdale Libraries, Mike Beck, seemed to suggest that might not fall under the ordinance's purview. While the program description includes DEI, the storytime format is geared toward special populations, he wrote. The monthly themes included Braille Storytime, Black History Month, and a session geared toward a sensory-based autism spectrum audience. The program receives no direct funding from the diversity office, he said. Scottsdale staff could run afoul of the new ordinance by either keeping or cutting the program. On one hand, it could be considered a violation because it explicitly says it promotes DEI. On the other hand, council members, including Quasman, said they were not trying to target the disabled community. They could opt to keep the program if they view it as more aimed at accessibility, which Vice Mayor Jan Duboskis said she viewed as separate from DEI. Where do residents file discrimination complaints right now? Because new ordinances don't take effect until 30 days after council approval, the Office of Diversity and Inclusion should still be responsible for handling discrimination, ADA, and Title VI complaints for the time being. Scottsdale's Office of Diversity and Inclusion webpage was still online and its email operating as of late Wednesday afternoon. The complaint form for discrimination was still available online. Asked Wednesday, city spokesperson Holly Peralta did not specify who would handle such complaints, but said details would be provided once they are determined. No direct services to the community, such as the handling of ADA compliance matters or the handling of discrimination complaints under Scottsdale's anti-discrimination ordinance, will be impacted, Peralta said. Where will the diversity director and ADA coordinators go? Peralta said city officials are working with Johnson and Borboa to match their interests and experience with organizational needs to find other suitable city positions. The two staff members are valued colleagues who remain part of the City of Scottsdale team, she said. Will the diversity director and ADA coordinator stay? Peralta said Wednesday, "We are not aware of any resignations specific to last night's council actions." What happens to Scottsdale's anti-discrimination ordinance? The ordinance remains in effect. Council members who voted to defund and ban DEI affirmed their commitment to the anti-discrimination ordinance at Tuesday's public meeting. What was unclear was who would be responsible for enforcing the ordinance, given it fell under the diversity office's purview. City spokespeople did not respond to questions on Wednesday. What happens to all the programs the diversity office hosted? City staff did not clarify Wednesday what would happen to each diversity office program. Next up is this piece from the Arizona Daily Star entitled, "Open Your Eyes to the Threat of Glaucoma," published February 5th, 2025. It's easy to take sight for granted when eyes are working as they should. When vision begins to diminish, people may seek the advice of an eye professional to determine if there's something they can do to prevent further deterioration. Glaucoma is the second leading cause of blindness in the world, advises the Cleveland Clinic. Unlike some other vision problems like cataracts that affect the lens or surface of the eye, glaucoma impacts the optic nerve directly. However, blindness from glaucoma often can be prevented with early treatment. Under pressure. Glaucoma is brought on by abnormal pressure buildup in the eye. The American Academy of Ophthalmology says the eye constantly makes a substance known as aqueous humor. When new aqueous humor flows into the eye, existing aqueous humor should drain out through an area called the drainage angle. But if the drainage angle is not working correctly, the fluid builds up, and intraocular pressure on the eye increases. Over time, this pressure damages the optic nerve. The primary function of the optic nerve is to transmit visual information from the retina to the brain. Open angle and closed angle glaucoma. The most common type of glaucoma is known as open angle glaucoma, which occurs when the drainage angle becomes blocked or there is resistance to the fluid draining out, says the Cleveland Clinic. This disease may go undetected for years because most people do not experience symptoms early on. The Mayo Clinic says gradual development of blind spots in the peripheral vision and, in later stages, difficulty seeing things in central vision may occur. In closed-angle glaucoma, also called angle closure glaucoma, a person's iris is very close to the drainage angle, and the iris itself can end up blocking the drainage angle. When the drainage angle becomes completely blocked, pressure in the eye can rapidly increase. The AAO says this is known as an acute attack and is a true emergency that can result in blindness. Signs of an acute attack include sudden blurry vision, severe eye pain, headache, nausea, vomiting, rainbow-colored rings or halos appearing around lights. Glaucoma risk factors. Glaucoma can affect anyone, but the risk increases with age, over 60, and is higher among Black and Hispanic populations. Asian and Inuit populations are more susceptible to closed-angle glaucoma, says the Cleveland Clinic. People with diabetes also have a much higher risk of getting glaucoma. In addition, individuals with a family history of glaucoma, people with high blood pressure, and people with previous eye injury or surgery are at risk for glaucoma. Treatment. The main treatment for glaucoma includes prescription eye drops that will decrease fluids and improve drainage in the eye. Laser therapy also may be recommended to help improve fluid drainage. Surgery also can achieve better eye pressure, but it is more invasive and additional methods may be tried first. Glaucoma is not something to take lightly. Routine eye exams that measure intraocular pressure can help determine if eyes are healthy. Next up is a piece from The New Yorker entitled, "What the Assault on Public Education Means for Kids with Disabilities." The future of the Department of Education may hinge on the worldview of two billionaires who abhor what they perceive as weakness and waste. By Jessica Winter, published February 13, 2025. President Donald Trump, winner of the Battle of the Billionaires at WrestleMania 23, has maintained close ties with Linda McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment, for decades. During the president's first term, she served for 2 years as head of the Small Business Administration, stepping down in 2019 to lead America First Action, a pro-Trump super PAC. Now, McMahon is Trump's nominee to run the U.S. Department of Education, although she may appear to lack conventional bona fides for the position. She did spend a year on the Connecticut Board of Education, although it later emerged that she did not have a degree in education, as she had claimed. If McMahon is confirmed by the Senate, her odd task will be to take charge of an agency in order to euthanize it. I told Linda, "Linda, I hope you do a great job and put yourself out of a job," Trump said on February 4th. His administration wants to abolish the Department of Education, which would require an act of Congress, or at least to shrink its remit, which encompasses the federal student loan program, Title I funding for low-income districts, special education services for students with disabilities, civil rights complaints, and more. In fact, this demolition work is well underway. Members of Elon Musk's slash-and-burn Dodge Squad have been inside the agency for the past week, placing staff members on paid leave, and, according to the Washington Post, feeding sensitive data from across the education department into artificial intelligence software to probe the agency's programs and spending. AI may have informed the agency's decision to cancel $900 million worth of existing contracts related to education research. NBC News reported that the agency will conduct an internal review aimed at ensuring the department grants do not fund discriminatory practices, including in the form of DEI. On February 7th, Democratic members of Congress attempted to enter the Department of Education building, only to have a security guard block their path. When one congressional representative posted on X about the incident, Musk replied, "No such department exists in the federal government." The Department of Education, assuming it exists, has the smallest staff of any cabinet agency, and its duties aren't necessarily well understood by the general public. Descriptions of its mission tend to rely on words like administer and oversight, terms which feel sticky with red tape. It does not decide how K-12 students in public schools are taught and evaluated. That's mostly the purview of individual states and local school districts. In most of these districts, the federal government provides a relatively modest percentage of a school's budget, usually in the ballpark of 13%, although it varies state by state. Trump often speaks in terms of sending all education and education work and needs back to the states. But most of the work of public education is already being done at the state and local level. Still, gutting the agency would deliver a terrible blow to public schools, particularly in rural areas and in high-density, low-income urban districts, which receive larger shares of their funding from the federal government. Advocates also fear that dismantling the Department of Education would have an immediate and tangible impact on students with disabilities. McMahon's mission is aligned with the school choice or education freedom movement, which, opponents say, seeks to erode people's trusts in public schools by starving them of resources, most tangibly through the support of charter schools and voucher programs, and by whipping up destabilizing controversies over critical race theory and gender ideology. The weaponry that the school choice movement wields in its attacks on public schools can be seen in two executive orders which President Trump issued on January 29th. One of those orders directed cabinet agencies to review how states can use federal funds to support families who choose educational alternatives to governmental entities, including private and faith-based options. In other words, the Trump administration wants to nationalize the K-12 voucher programs already offered in 17 states, in which public money is rerouted to parents who want to put it toward tuition at a private or parochial school, or toward homeschooling expenses. The other executive order, which addressed ending radical indoctrination in K-12 schooling, threatened to withhold federal funding from any school that foists anti-American, subversive, harmful, and false ideologies on our nation's children, including steering students toward surgical and chemical mutilation and demanding acquiescence to white privilege. It also instructed the heads of multiple agencies to devise plans to monitor and punish such schools. Dan Stewart, the managing attorney for education and employment at the National Disability Rights Network, a legal advocacy group, told me that through these executive orders, this administration is engaging with education at the micro level as well as the macro level. It's looking at curriculum, which is traditionally in the power of the local schools and the state, at the same time that it's looking at different ways of moving public dollars out of the system. There's ample evidence that voucher programs have negative educational outcomes and place an enormous strain on state budgets. It's not popular at the ballot box either. In the most recent election cycle, Kentucky voted almost 2-1 against Amendment 2, which would have permitted the state legislature to put tax dollars toward charter schools and vouchers. Strikingly, the measure did not receive a majority in a single county across the state. pro-school choice ballot measures also failed in Colorado and Nebraska. Still, both the America First Policy Institute, AFPI, the public policy think tank, which McMahon chairs, and the Heritage Foundation, where Project 2025 germinated, have backed the Education Choice for Children Act, which would introduce a federal tax credit to incentivize charitable donations to voucher programs. The AFPI estimates that the bill would enable 85% to 90% of students in the nation to benefit from school choice via scholarships, and singled out Arizona's voucher program as a successful model, one which has saved taxpayer money and come in under budget. This is a mind-bending endorsement by McMahon's think tank. According to the nonprofit Save Our Schools Arizona, the state's school choice program cost $900 million over the 2023-24 fiscal year, exceeding its budget by $300 million. It now accounts for nearly half of Arizona's overall budget shortfall. Most of the families who enrolled in the program were not moving their children out of public schools. The vouchers instead serve as a discount on the private tuition they were already paying, and, as SOS Arizona put it, represent an entirely new cost to the state. Even setting aside the grim financial burdens imposed by voucher programs, there are many families for whom education freedom does not offer much in the way of school choice. Some of these families live in rural and often Republican-dominated communities where private school options are limited or non-existent, and where public schools are major local employers. Voucher programs only bleed their budgets. Other families can't afford to make up the difference between the scholarship their child receives through a state voucher program and the actual tuition charged by local private schools. And still others have children with physical, intellectual, or social-emotional disabilities whose rights in school are guaranteed in the federal law known as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. The vast majority of IDEA rights only apply to public school students. Jessica Levine, who is litigation director at the nonprofit Education Law Center, told me, IDEA mandates certification requirements for special education teachers and shields students from being punished for manifestations of their disability. It also enshrines parents' rights to be involved in developing their children's education plans and to argue for more or different services, which can range from speech-language or occupational therapy to assistive technology. These rights are all lost when a student goes to a private school, Levine said. Project 2025 proposes rolling federal Title I and special education funding into block grants, which states can administer without extensive federal oversight. The states would no longer have a check on how they are complying with IDEA or other federal laws, Stewart said. The likely scenario for kids with special needs, he went on, is fewer teachers, fewer funds, delayed funds, and less certainty. Of course, according to the school choice movement, parents who are dissatisfied with their child's cash-strapped public school should have the opportunity to choose a private one in a thriving educational marketplace. In reality, Levine says, private schools are legally allowed to not accept students with disabilities or serve them appropriately, and so you end up with a higher concentration of higher needs students in schools that now have fewer resources. A dismal irony of the intersection of school choice and special education is that not even the most vehement supporter of public schools would argue that the system currently works well for kids with disabilities. Currently, the federal government only provides about 13% of the average per-student cost of special education services under IDEA, down from its original pledge of 40% a half century ago when IDEA was first passed into law. The vast majority of states do not fully fund special education, leaving districts to cover the gap by dipping into their general education budgets, or not. Often, they don't provide the legally mandated services at all. Public and private schools alike, Stewart told me, are incentivized to view students with disabilities as a drain on their resources. Underfunded districts in red, blue, and purple states routinely fail these students, whether they are illegally capping the percentage of children who can receive services or willfully keeping parents in the dark about their constitutional rights. IDEA is perhaps a law too aptly named, as its protections often seem more theoretical than concrete. But if public education devolves into state voucher programs, as it could under the Trump administration, families will lose support in both theory and practice, and the possible effects on kids with special needs could be compounded by Trump's radical indoctrination executive order. Although the order targets diversity efforts which focus on race, color, sex, or national origin, the conceptual framework of DEI includes the goal of greater accessibility and inclusion for people with disabilities. It's not clear whether Trump, Musk, or their supporters realize that an assault on DEI can be logically construed as an assault on rights for the disabled. The attack on DEI as a whole implicates long-standing interpretations of disability rights that have been ratified by the Supreme Court and federal courts, Stewart said. They are changing the underlying legal and social understandings of disability, even though that's not the primary goal of the attack. The future of the Department of Education and of the students with disabilities who depend on it will likely hinge less on the person appointed to lead it than on the worldviews of two billionaires who abhor what they perceive as weakness and waste. Children, alas, are weak and wasteful by nature, to say nothing of a child who needs a wheelchair, a hearing aid, or a paraprofessional. Trump and Musk's public statements are instructive here. In 2023, Musk fired a longtime employee of his who has muscular dystrophy and then ridiculed him on Twitter, falsely claiming that he did no actual work. Musk later apologized and indicated that the employee could remain at Twitter. He did not. As for Trump, according to a memoir written by his nephew, the disability advocate Fred Trump III, the president once commented that some disabled people should just die, and said of Fred's own son, who is nonverbal and uses a wheelchair owing to a rare genetic disorder, maybe you should just let him die. These remarks may be useful to keep in mind as we watch what befalls the Education Department in the weeks and months to come. Our leaders don't want to make public education run more efficiently or to strengthen it through competition. They just think it does no actual work and that they should just let it die. Now, here's a piece from WCAX in Burlington, Vermont, entitled, "Those with Visual Impairments or Blindness Tackling the Trails at Pico Mountain," by Connor Ullathorne, published February 8, 2025, Mendon, Vermont. Saturday was one busy day on the slopes. That included for those with visual impairments or blindness tackling the trails at Pico Mountain. I really thought when I lost my vision, everything was going to be over for me, and Vermont Adaptive gave me hope again that I could start going back out there and go back to my old activities, because I've been skiing since I was 5, Willow Windelosky of Massachusetts said. After an accident took her vision when she was 15, Willow Windelosky was one of the hundreds of skiers and riders that packed the lift lines at Pico Mountain Saturday. She's part of Vermont Adaptive's 16th VI/Blind Athlete Winter Festival, one of 20 skiers and riders hitting the slopes with visual impairments. I finally had people who knew what I was going through, and seeing them succeed and completely like moving on with their lives and doing so many amazing things, Windelosky said. The program is made for all level of skiers. Athletes wear earpieces and steer with the help of multiple guides to stay safe on the slopes. Athletes say the camaraderie gives them confidence on the slopes. It's very intimidating as it is to be visually impaired, blind, and doing outdoorsy things like this is just scary. but having people who are just very experienced skiers giving me a lot of feedback and pointers, Melissa Bloom of New Jersey said. The camaraderie that these folks experience, it's amazing, it's impactful, and we see the same people come back year after year, and we see new faces, so it becomes quite a good group, Aaron Fernandez, Vermont Adaptive Executive Director, said. Executive Director Aaron Fernandez says it takes a whole effort from over 100 volunteers, guides, and family members to create the perfect weekend. But for the athletes, many always look forward to returning each year. It just makes me want to come back. I only ski once a year, and this is the only opportunity I have. There's not many programs that allow this to happen, Bloom said. The VI Blind Winter Festival continues Sunday with more skiing, riding, and snowshoeing. Here's a reminder that you're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Now, here's an announcement from the American Foundation for the Blind. Author Andrew Leland receives 2025 Helen Keller Achievement Award, New York, February 13, 2025. The American Foundation for the Blind, AFB, is pleased to announce author Andrew Leland will be among those to receive the prestigious Helen Keller Achievement Award, which AFB will present during a special evening ceremony on April 24th in Midtown Manhattan. Recognized for his outstanding contributions as a published author and journalist, Mr. Leland brings a body of published work that exemplifies Helen Keller's own artistry in crafting narratives with mass appeal. Mr. Leland's gift to wield words in a way that both informs and inspires us offers our generation a powerful voice capturing the blind experience in modern life, said Eric Bridges, AFB President and CEO. Helen Keller knew well the power that personal narrative could play toward altering perceptions, and it's clear Andrew's craft as a storyteller carries on Keller's legacy of bridging culture and humanity through the power of words. Mr. Leland's nonfiction book, The Country of the Blind, A Memoir at the End of Sight, published in 2023 on Penguin Random House, received strong praise from the literary community. The book chronicles his experience of losing sight due to retinitis pigmentosa, while offering a deeper look into blind culture. Further published works through print, radio, and podcasting speak to the hearts of millions of people who are blind or have low vision. For his collective body of work, Mr. Leland is quickly becoming one of the leading voices within the disability community. His memoir was a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize, and his audio works have received tens of millions of listeners across the globe. He currently serves as the Koppel Fellow in Journalism at Wesleyan University. Since 1994, the Helen Keller Achievement Award has recognized the finest thought leaders, changemakers, and performing artists committed to carrying on Keller's mission to create a world of full and equal opportunity for people with disabilities. For over 40 years, Helen Keller was AFB's leading ambassador, inspiring millions worldwide as she demonstrated all that can be accomplished through determination and perseverance. AFB continues to honor Keller's legacy by recognizing exceptional individuals and organizations from industry, education, and the arts who have distinguished themselves in pursuit of expanding possibilities for those who are blind, deafblind, or have low vision. Past honorees include author and advocate Haben Girma, tech leader and entrepreneur Bernard Newcomb, chef Christine Ha, filmmaker Sean Levy, and performing artists Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder. Founded in 1921, the American Foundation for the Blind creates equal opportunities and expands possibilities for people who are blind, deafblind, or have low vision through advocacy, thought leadership, and strategic partnerships. In addition to publishing the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness, JVIB, AFB is also the proud steward of the Helen Keller Archive, which is available on the AFB website at www.afb.org. And now, a piece from the Los Angeles Times entitled, Disneyland Visitor Launches Class Action Suit Over New Stricter Disability Passes, by Andrew J. Campa. Published February 12, 2025. Last July, San Diego resident Tricia Malone applied for a disability exemption at a booth just outside the Disneyland and California Adventure theme parks. The Disability Access Service, or DAS, pass she wanted would have allowed her to avoid waiting in time-consuming lines for popular Disney rides. Malone met with personnel representing Disney for her DAS application interview. In that public setting, they solicited private medical information from the disabled woman. After a short exchange, Malone was rejected, as her disability did not meet new, stricter DAS standards. That denial was detailed in a 32-page class action complaint Malone filed against Walt Disney Parks and Resorts, along with partner Inspire Health Alliance in Orange County Superior Court on Monday. Malone's complaint claims Disney breached confidentiality and invaded her privacy and violated the UNRRA Civil Rights Act and several California civil rights codes. The woman's attorneys claim in the complaint the new DAS pass standard unlawfully excludes individuals with other disabilities. The complaint did not provide any details on the plaintiff's disability. She is asking Disney to revert to a previous, less restrictive version of DAS pass enforcement. She's also looking for statutory damages, restitution, and the cost of attorney's fees. The Ontario-based McCune Law Group, which is representing Malone, issued a statement on her behalf, saying the case is about the people the DAS pass is meant to benefit. Disney has arbitrarily determined that a wide range of disabilities do not qualify as such under the Disability Access Service Program, the email statement read. The park cannot provide a great experience for all, while its DAS program continues to target and marginalize those it purports to support and protect. A Disney spokesperson, who asked not to be named, said, "The park strives to provide a great experience for its disabled visitors. Disney offers a broad range of effective disability accommodations and has worked extensively with experts to ensure that our guests' individual needs are properly matched with the accommodation they require, and we believe the claims in this complaint are without merit," the spokesperson said. Disney's DAS pass is not a license to skip waiting. Rather, it provides a pass holder a return time for an attraction where they'll be placed in line with those who have paid for Express or Lightning Lane access. In April, Disney announced it was changing the DAS qualifications. The new wording noted that the DAS program, then the most popular at the park, was intended to accommodate those guests who, due to a developmental disability like autism or similar, were unable to wait in a conventional queue for an extended period of time. The changes went into effect May 20 at Disney World and June 18 at Disneyland. Older standards were much broader for guests who have difficulty tolerating extended waits in a conventional queue environment due to a disability. Disney said that as a result of that language, the program's usage tripled between 2019 and 2024. It's these older standards, however, that Malone is requesting. Malone is suing on behalf of several unnamed disabled clients denied a DAS pass since June 18. She included Inspire Health Alliance, which the lawsuit claims provided nurse practitioners who collaborated with Disney staff to determine DAS pass worthiness. Malone's attorneys argue in the complaint that requiring guests to undergo a screening process with eligibility criteria that disproportionately affects individuals with physical disabilities is contrary to California's UNRRA Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. UNRRA bans discrimination by California businesses based on age, ancestry, color, disability, national origin, and a variety of other factors. Disney has maintained in previous interviews with The Times that it offers many accommodations for its disabled guests. Those include a sensory experience guide to indicate which parts of the park have loud noises, darkness, and bumpiness, which rides are fast, and which lift off the ground. Disney also offers sign language interpreters, wheelchair and scooter rentals, assistive handheld captioning and video captioning on some rides, and dialogue and narration of scripts on others. As for ride waiting, Disney offers a return to queue process, which allows a party to hold a place in line for a guest with disabilities. There are a few other similar options, including a location return time accommodation offered to those in wheelchairs. Malone's attorneys said those accommodations failed to provide equitable access and imposed undue burdens, logistical challenges, and emotional distress and safety risks. Next up is a piece from New Mobility entitled Meet the Wheelchair User Solving Accessible Parking Abuse by Ian Reuter, published February 13, 2025. After 15 years of collecting data and working to improve the accessible parking system, Mac Marsh is confident he has the solution to end accessible parking abuse. Not only that, he can sum it up in one word: education. Before you laugh, consider that Marsh isn't just out here spitballing. He's one of the few people with tangible success tackling one of the most vexing and rampant accessibility issues in America. His nonprofit, Parking Mobility, collects violation reports from around the world and has implemented offender education programs for communities across Texas. We've got one county here in Texas where the third year in the program, we issued over 3,000 citations in that county, and not a single citation was issued to a resident of that county, he says. So, in 3 years, his team educated an entire community. Marsh knows he and his team have found an effective solution because they have the real-world data to prove it. We've had over 25,000 people that have gone through our offender education course, and we've only had 8 repeat offenders, he says. That's almost a 0% recidivism rate, which is unheard of in a program like this. For Marsh, the biggest remaining question is how to scale up the program so it starts making an impact across the country. A heat stroke of genius. Fittingly, Marsh's road to becoming one of the nation's leading advocates for accessible parking reform began with someone blocking the space for his ramp. Just a few months after getting out of rehab for the 2001 spinal cord injury that made him a C6 quad, Marsh was attending a baseball game with his young son. When the Louisiana heat started to catch up to him, he and his son went to get in the van, only to find someone had parked in the striped area, blocking his entry. His son ran to get help, but it was too late. "I didn't realize that my body doesn't regulate its temperature," he says. "By the time my son got back, I had passed out from heat stroke and left for the hospital in an ambulance." Marsh's frustration was compounded by the realization that the person who had blocked his access never learned the impact of his actions. When that guy got back from his ball game, he got in his car and left and never knew what happened. He never got educated, says Marsh. "That really set me on a course to better understand this issue." Exasperation into action. Marsh and a small team launched Parking Mobility in 2010. In its early iterations, the nonprofit revolved around a free app that made it easy for users to report disabled parking violators using their smartphone camera. "I was exasperated as to why people couldn't solve this problem, why law enforcement wouldn't do anything about it, and why judges weren't doing anything about it," he says. A self-professed data guy, Marsh envisioned the app as a data collection tool that would help advocates show policymakers the need for reform. The app gathered over 1,000 reports per week, and the additional data was telling. It highlighted two critical issues. One, a lack of education. And two, fines weren't changing behavior. People think punishing violators will make them change their behavior, but the recidivism rate amongst people who get a ticket, people who pay the fine and then repeat offend, is over 60%. So high fines don't change behavior, Marsh says. Parking Mobility worked to develop a solution that incorporated these realities and also the fact that confronting violators on the spot rarely achieves the desired impact. People who are confronted at the point of infraction go into fight or flight. If they go into fight mode, they're going to justify a lot and say ugly things. They're going to escalate the issue, but it's not going to change their behavior. They will repeat offend, he says. If they go into the flight mode, they tend to apologize and promise never to do it again. The reality is, they do it again, because it doesn't educate them. They're not open to that education at the point of infraction. A better solution. Violators caught via the Parking Mobility app receive a ticket in the mail a week later, informing them they have an option to take a class instead of paying the fine. That drives them into that education, which then engages them in a really positive manner and not in a negative, punitive way, he says. Parking Mobility tailors its education programs to local rules, regulations, and customs. It currently operates these programs in 15 Texas communities and is looking to expand. One major metropolitan Texas city told Marsh it loved his program but didn't want to implement it because it couldn't afford to lose the $3.5 million in revenue it generated from accessible parking violators. Undeterred, Marsh and Parking Mobility continue to seek out local partners nationwide. Ideally, Parking Mobility would like to partner with local nonprofits to reach out to legislators about adopting their program. We need local superstars that are willing to use the app correctly and willing to work with us to talk with and learn how to talk with their community leaders, he says. Enforcement can help nonprofit partners generate revenue, as Parking Mobility shares a percentage of the contracts it signs with local municipalities, in addition to sharing violation and education fees. United Spinal Association recognized Marsh's efforts in 2024 by selecting him as the recipient of the first ever James J. Peters Community Builder Award, honoring an individual who has achieved significant social progress for wheelchair users in the realm of rights, support services, accessibility, or career advancement. Marsh has a clear message for anyone who has been affected, frustrated, or even enraged by accessible parking violators. I get being angry. I do. I've gotten angry before myself, but you got to direct that anger in a positive direction. You've got to be able to take a proactive approach to it. Get involved with a program like Parking Mobility. Or, if you already have a volunteer program in your community, become a part of that so that you can address this issue in a proper manner, he says. To find out more about Parking Mobility, visit parkingmobility.com or email Marsh at mac@parkingmobility.org. For answers to all of your questions about disabled parking, including enforcement, advocacy, and more, make sure to download United Spinal's The Complete Guide to Accessible Parking. This free e-pamphlet was created by a working group of United Spinal members to educate the public and promote better enforcement of disabled parking. This next article comes from the Disability Scoop. It's entitled, D-Word Billboards Aim to Get People Talking About Disabilities, by Ryan Boldry, published February 18, 2025. Kalamazoo, Michigan. An eye-catching campaign is usually a successful one. Allison Lease hopes that's the case with the latest Disability Network Southwest Michigan campaign. There's no doubt it's eye-catching. This past month, it started popping up on 14-by-48-foot billboards towering over downtown Kalamazoo and along US 131 and I-94, with a gigantic hashtag D-word as the dominant visual. The billboards were made possible by Adams Outdoor Advertising, who donated the space to the nonprofit for 2025. The idea is to make viewers pause. That's, after all, the intent behind the message, said Lease, the communications and outreach manager of DNSWM. If people follow the billboard's suggestion and visit dwordpride.org, they can learn more about the campaign, which states emphatically, disability is not a bad word. For a long time, people have shied away from using the term disability because they don't want to be offensive, Lease said. People don't know that it's an okay thing to talk about disability. So they use euphemisms or words that make them feel better, like special needs or handicapable. We just want people to know that there's nothing wrong with saying disability. The more we talk about it, the more normalized and accepted disability becomes. It's not a bad thing to have a disability, so just say the word. That's kind of our goal behind the campaign. Lease, 37, has been with DNSWM for 12 years. Growing up, her older brother Larry was diagnosed with autism as a young child, inspiring Lease to get involved. Doctors in the 1980s told her parents her brother would never be able to do anything, she said. It's made me very passionate about trying to make sure that he could live life in the way that he wanted to and that opportunities weren't going to be denied to him simply because he's autistic, Lease said. Going through elementary, middle, and high school, I would see people make assumptions about what he could do. They'd say, he's probably never going to be able to do this or that. And we would say, he's already doing those things. You're just counting him out. So advocacy just became part of our lives, and it just continued. Lease lives with a disability herself. Diagnosed with ADHD at 25, she didn't know growing up that mental health needs can also be considered disabilities. A lot of people have mental health needs, but they have no idea that they have a disability, she said. And that goes back to the fact that in our society and our schools and places we grow up, we don't tend to talk about disabilities. Disability Network Southwest Michigan helps people of all ages with any type of disability to navigate life with a goal of helping people live more independently. They do that through weekly peer support groups for adults with autism, people with brain injuries, and people dealing with chronic pain. They also have a group for women with any type of disability. A lot of organizations require some type of proof of disability, and we don't, which makes us really unique, Lease said. If you say you have a disability, then we help you. DNSWM also has programs to support people when rights are being violated. In addition, the organization works with clients on self-advocacy and helps connect people to community programs that assist with basic resources such as transportation, housing, health care, and food. Disability Network also offers free consultations to businesses and nonprofits who wish to become more disability-friendly and accessible. That can be as simple as helping design spaces to become easier to get in and out of. Another example is helping select lights with people who have sensory issues in mind. Disability impacts everybody, Lease said. Every gender, every race, every socioeconomic status. You can live your entire life and never think about disability, and then, because of a health condition or an accident, disability can become the center of your world. When that happens, Lise said, she hopes they turn to DNSWM first. A couple years ago, somebody told us that we are one of the best-kept secrets in Southwest Michigan, and that really stuck with us, Lee said. We don't want to be a secret. We think about ourselves as the first stop for people with disabilities. If we don't have a service or a program that supports what somebody is in need of, we can connect that person to another program or organization. The Kalamazoo-based Disability Services and Support Organization has been serving the community since 1981, born out of the disability rights movement of the 70s. A rallying cry of the movement, Lee said, was "Nothing about us without us." People with disabilities were tired of people without disabilities making decisions for them on how they should live their lives without their input, she said. As a result, disability networks, such as the one in Kalamazoo, started popping up all over the country. Known as Centers for Independent Living, a requirement at each is that a minimum of 51% of staff and board members must have a disability, Lee said. Of the 34 people that make up DNSWM's staff and governing board, that number hovers just above 80%. And that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us for the Disability News Program. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. I hope you'll join us again next time. And keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.